Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, some unusual news coming out of the 9th Congressional District rematch involving former Congressman Robert Pittenger and two current candidates. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden's department is involved in speed enforcement in Cornelius, stirring up some controversy. Most UNC system student IDs fail to pass muster for use as voter IDs, causing a kerfuffle in Raleigh. And Charlotte offers higher buildings in exchange for more affordable housing. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and more. And those reporters include Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joe Bruno is here from WSOC-TV Eyewitness News. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer is here. Hi.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg is back. He's the managing editor for the Charlotte Business Journal.
Good morning, Mike.
Well, good morning to you.
Well,
we're all here around our
studio. We're all happy.
Yes, sir. We're all here around our table at Spirit Square. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. Former 9th District Congressman Robert Pittenger lost in the primary to Mark Harris, decided not to participate in the rematch in the 9th District. Still, he's making news in that contest over retracted emails that commented on fellow Republican Dan Bishop, who is running, and Bishop, a lawyer, threatened to sue. What, pray tell, did those emails say?
Robert Pittenger sends out this email blast endorsing Matthew Reinauer, the former Mecklenburg County Commissioner. Mm-hmm. But in that same email, he goes on to bash Dan Bishop, saying that he basically was an advisor for Mark Harris's campaign and he knew about the fraudulent activities that McRae Dallas was doing. A short time later, Dan Bishop emails all the reporters a letter that he sent to the Robert Pittenger, and it says, "Robert Pittenger defamed me. He will retract his lies or he will be sued."
Wow.
And he retracted his lies.
Yes, he did.
retracted his statement anyway.
Yes.
Jason Williams, who was Mark Harris's campaign manager, also refuted Pittenger's claim that Dan Bishop was a primary advisor to the Mark Harris campaign with knowledge of McRae Dallas's fraudulent activities.
We were fortunate to have the endorsement of Senator Bishop in our campaign, just as we were fortunate to have the endorsement of Congressman Robert Pittenger in the campaign. But Senator Bishop was certainly not involved in any type of advisory capacity or any type of strategic level or anything like that.
So Pittenger, as you said, Eric, quickly retracted what he said in his email with this comment, quote, "I retract the statement about Dan Bishop as it was false." Did he know it was false when he wrote it?
We don't know that, but it certainly was a very quick retraction. And dare I say this might not be the most effective endorsement of a candidate running for Congress that we've seen in some time.
This whole thing in the 9th District is real. It's a mess.
It never ends. I mean, it never ends.
In his response, Bishop said that he understood the bitterness that Robert Pittenger might feel over his loss to Mark Harris in the primary last year, but he said he shouldn't take that bitterness by publishing lies about Bishop. This is Bishop talking.
Right.
And he said that Bishop defamed me today. He will retract his false statements or be sued. Pittenger and Bishop are two of the most prominent Republicans in the state. What is behind this? Is it just the fact that he didn't endorse Bishop or that he endorsed Matthew Reinauer over Bishop? What is this about?
Well, I mean, first of all, when you make that statement that someone knowingly participated in fraudulent activities, it's going to get a very strong response, and it did. And I can only assume that what gave it greater power, of course, is that Dan Bishop is an attorney. So it didn't feel like I might sue you. He could do that pretty quickly, which led to our speedy retraction, I suppose.
And evidently, Robert Pittenger has made a comment about Dan Bishop being the architect of HB2, which sent the state into a tailspin several years ago because athletic leagues and games and contests and Broadway shows refused to come here for several
years. Put a dollar in the jar.
That's right. Thank you. Some states even still today will allow their employees to come to North Carolina because the law that repealed HB2 is still kind of HB2-ish in their point of view. And Pittenger criticized Bishop for poorly communicating House Bill 2, which created an unnecessary backlash with significant economic job loss to the state. Did Pittenger speak this way at the time?
I was just about to say, Mike, I don't know the answer, but that is the question that popped into my head as well. What was his comment on HB 2 at the time? I honestly don't recall. Does anyone remember Pittenger speaking out?
And finally, there is a finally to this. Well, finally.
Well, no. Finally, it's just to be continued.
Finally, this week, Pittenger is endorsing, as you mentioned, former Mecklenburg County Commissioner Matthew Ridenhour, because he says he believes Ridenhour's business experience and the fact that he's a former Marine would make him the best candidate to beat another former Marine and businessman, Democrat Dan McCready. Pittenger says McCready's independent country before party stance would last about a week in Congress when he realizes he won't receive committee assignments, future campaign funding, international travel, or be considered for leadership posts. And that, my friends, in a nutshell, is what's wrong with Congress.
Well, you know, one thing that really strikes me about this is, however you feel about Robert Pittenger, this was a very aggressive letter at minimum, and certainly had a lot of fight in it. And what I wonder is, why didn't he fight the primary results? Again, remember, he was victim, potentially, of what was going on in Bladen County in that primary, lost narrowly to Mark Harris, and never challenged it. And then to come out months later with this kind of letter, it's hard to follow.
And why not run again?
Right, exactly. If you're not going to run again, which he'd already said he wouldn't, and you've kind of resigned yourself to going on and working on other things, then why jump back in and get into this mess that he did this week? It's a little bit confounding.
There's no rhyme nor reason for any of this. Well, meanwhile, candidate filing in the 9th District race ended, I believe, last Friday after we left the air, and the field is now set with the largest slate of GOP candidates running since 2012. That's just only a couple of years ago. So I don't know what the real significance of that is. But aside from Dan Bishop and Matthew Ridenhour, whom we've all already mentioned, who are these people that are running in this district?
Well, we have Union County Commissioner Stoney Rushing, former state lawmaker Fern Schubert. Also from Mecklenburg County, we have perennial candidate Gary Dunn. From Fayetteville, we have Stevie Rivenbark. We also have two realtors, Kathy Day and Lee Brown. Neither of them live in the district. And I am...
Gary, did you mention Gary Dunn?
Gary Dunn, and I am missing...
The Albert Lee Wiley Jr.?
He lives in the Outer Banks. That's probably why I forgot him.
Right. So there are 13 candidates in the race now, 10 Republicans, Democrat Dan McCready, who will not be in the primary because he's running unopposed, and a Green Party and a Libertarian Party candidate. Anyone know anything about those two people?
No.
Jeff Scott, he ran against Tark Bakar. He went to the hearing every day when the Mark Harris hearing was happening in Raleigh. So he's been pretty involved in the 9th District.
Okay. And only the Republican candidates, am I right about this? Only the Republicans will be involved in the primary.
Right. Correct. May 14th.
Okay. And if there needs to be a runoff?
Would be in September.
September 10th.
Otherwise, that would be the day of the election.
Of the general election.
Yes. Correct. Yes.
And if there's a runoff, it'll be in November.
Right.
If the general election. When we won't know all this till after the primaries, right?
Correct.
Correct.
Wow.
Remember, the threshold is now 30%, not 40%.
Okay. And when will the winner of this contest, whether it's the Democrat, the Republican, the Green Party, or the Libertarian, when will they be running for re-election?
Oh, that'll be the next Tuesday.
Tuesday. Yeah. It's very sad.
Yes.
Meanwhile, this is very interesting to me. Chaz Beasley has announced that he is launching a campaign for North Carolina Lieutenant Governor. This seems premature. Is it early?
A lot of people, for some reason, are paying attention to the Lieutenant Governor race and hopping in this. Chaz Beasley's running. Terry Van Dyne from the Asheville area is running. Cal Cunningham. And Malcolm Graham even said that he's going to take a look at the seat. Scott Stone on the Republican side. Jim Puckett has said he wants to take a look at running for that seat as well. So Lieutenant Governor race is going to be pretty competitive.
Become a very popular job all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask. Why?
Why not run
for governor?
Why
do we do it this way? Why don't we do it like president and vice president, run on the same ticket?
I believe North Carolina at one time did have them paired. but I could be wrong. But I think that one thing that people might be looking at is, it's pretty wide open. There's no obvious candidate that's in the lead in terms of lieutenant governor. And the current lieutenant governor is going to run for governor. So maybe people look at that as a stepping stone.
And I wonder why people aren't running for Senate. Right now, there isn't a solid, front runner. There isn't somebody in people's minds that automatically stands out from the Democratic side to run against Tillis. We have, of course, Trevor Fuller has said that he's exploring a run, but I believe the DSCC is still looking for a candidate.
Well, interesting, because Democrats feel that Tom Tillis could be vulnerable. And of course, there was the talk in the past couple of weeks about him possibly facing a primary after the Trump back and forth, so that'll be interesting.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. The lieutenant governor, what does the lieutenant governor do?
That's a great question, Mike.
You don't, nobody knows.
Let me ruminate on that for a few minutes.
They preside over the Senate.
That is true. They run the Senate. That's true. Yes. Because you always hear Dan Forrest running the Senate. That's true.
Okay. All right.
So now we know. Thank you, Joe. You saved me.
It's a great job. I'm going to run for it. The county commission went through the plans for Brooklyn Village on Tuesday night. That is the $683 million development that will obliterate Marshall Park as we know it, replace it with a smaller park space, and add 1,243 apartments and condos, 114 of them set aside for low-income residents. It will also, there will also be shops and restaurants and offices and hotel rooms. There was hope in some circles that the amount of park space could be increased, but commissioners were told on Tuesday resoundingly, I think by Dina DiIorio, no. Why?
Because they had already voted on this last summer.
And why were they still hoping that it could be increased?
I don't know. I think that maybe Commissioner Fuller and others thought that they were approving an outline, basically, and then could go back and negotiate this. But from what the county manager said, it didn't sound like that's possible.
I did this story on Tuesday night, and it just struck me how many people had no idea that Marshall Park is going to be eventually bulldozed.
How could they not know? We talked about this for weeks. Do you know that Marshall Park is the beauty shot for the park in The Young and the Restless?
Looky
How
there.
About that?
Really?
Wow.
It's the beauty shot when they do a scene in that park.
I was not expecting that.
You know, one thing, too, we talk about with Marshall Park is that Marshall Park is where a lot of the protests are. And
yes.
And I think probably a lot of people have been giving them a hard time about it, you know, saying that we want a larger park. And think about any of the lots of people gather there when there's an issue that protesters are out there talking about. And also, I remember when a lot of this was going on in the early stages, they talked about, okay, we want to maintain this as the history of that neighborhood, African-Americans who live there, and you're not hearing a lot of that now. You're talking about some of them will be affordable units, but you're not talking about keeping that history when that was a majority African-American
community. They're giving a tip of the hat to Brooklyn by calling it Brooklyn Village, but this will be nothing like Brooklyn.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah. And you heard, exactly. was it Vilma Leek said, I get excited about this, and then as I look at the details, I get sad,
right.
Referring, I think, to the fact that none of the history or the makeup of this redevelopment will be anything like what the original Brooklyn was.
Why couldn't they leave part of Marshall Park, like the little pond and the bridge? Why couldn't they leave that and build around it?
This was the agreement they negotiated, and I know some commissioners were fighting for that. Pat Cotham has been very vocal about how she thinks more park space should have been there.
When will they break ground for this?
2 years, likely. It's going to be a while.
So there's still time to nix it, right? Guess not. We're going to continue in just a moment, and we'll talk more about Sheriff McFadden. We'll talk about him when we come back. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That is why Katie Peralta is here from the Charlotte Observer, along with Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from Channel 9 Eyewitness News, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Cornelius residents were in the news this week. They got a surprise this past weekend from Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden. He ran what is called a safety operation, what some would call a speed trap up in that area, and it got residents upset, to say the least. Sheriff McFadden attended the Cornelius Town Commissioners meeting this week, and evidently they grilled him on this. Would that be accurate to say?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of tension in that room.
Why?
I think that they were unhappy with the, what were your delicate words, speed trap that they encountered
up
there. Safety operation. And Sheriff McFadden did not back down and, in fact, said that this is going to be more commonplace under his leadership as sheriff. So he was not yielding at all.
And evidently a lot of residents also turned out for Monday's meeting.
When something doesn't look right, you better figure out what's going on because there's probably something wrong.
It's my expectation that public employees would show each other more professional respect and exhibit more courtesy amongst themselves than was evident in this instance.
So were they complaining about the sheriff setting up a speed trap or the way the conversation between the sheriff and county commissioners was conducted?
Well, I think wasn't part of this that they did not notify the town police that they were doing
this? Yeah, the Cornelius commissioners say they were caught off guard by the whole thing. One of them claims his phone was ringing off the hook asking what the deal is, and he had no idea what to tell him because it wasn't coordinated with Cornelius PD or the town.
And they were confused as to why it was going on during the All-Star weekend, too, which wasn't it the All-Star weekend in February?
That's right.
That was brought up.
But, but newsflash, the All-Star game was downtown.
Correct.
Exactly.
Involved a lot of security down here.
And you also see things like this set up during St. Patrick's Day when they know people are going to be doing a lot of drinking New Year's Eve. So they brought that up, but he also brought up the sheriff did in terms of privilege. Yeah. And he talked about that there are other areas where they do this all the time, and this area, we need to mention, is a very high-income area. It leads, if I'm not mistaken, to the lakefront homes, the million-dollar homes. And he said that, you know, other areas that we do this in all the time and we have the right to do it, you don't hear them complaining or you don't hear the outcry. And he felt like he said, I didn't come here to get this kind. I thought I was coming here to be welcomed. And it even talked about it was when they said, well, we didn't mean to disrespect you. He said it's a little too late for that.
Yeah. And he also said it's an African-American sheriff making differences in this city and county. I wasn't welcomed here. So he clearly was frustrated.
Let's let Gary McFadden speak for himself here.
Is it really about this? Or is it about privilege? Let's ask ourselves, is it about privilege? Let's think about it. We all danced around it already. It's about privilege. It's about privilege. It's an African-American sheriff making differences in this city and county. I wasn't welcomed here. I was brought here. So you can ask me questions tonight.
He quickly added that he wasn't mad because he has to serve each and every one of you. But wow, is that what this was about? Privilege and the intersection of race or law enforcement and the intersection with privilege? I mean, your Glenn Counts over at Channel 9 talked to him about this after that meeting. Do you know what he told Glenn about this?
I think he really wants to focus this being on this is how he's going to operate the sheriff's office. In the past, the sheriff really was just focused on executing warrants and, you know, running security at the jail. But he has the ability to have these speed enforcement traps, and he wants to use them. And that means that they're going to be all throughout the county. They're not just going to be in Charlotte. They're not just going to be in the southern section. Cornelius, Huntersville, Davidson, these areas should expect this.
But was this about people who are generally wealthier than the average guy up in that area because they have these million-dollar lake homes, about them assuming that they can just go as fast as they want down a 35-mile-per-hour road and not be ticketed because they have privilege? Or was it about the fact that we have an African-American sheriff who's chosen to police that part of town?
It wasn't completely. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it sounds like some people are looking at it as a little bit of both. And it came to mind. You had Mark Lamont Hill on earlier on your show on Charlotte Talks, talking about the privilege issue and how that you get, say, for instance, more crime and more arrest because you're not looking in certain areas. You're not looking. He mentioned the Harvards and the Yale for drugs or whatever. You're not having these speed traps in areas like that. So that's where that, I think that privilege issue that people are talking about comes in.
And there had been some pretty bad accidents on Jatan turning into the neighborhoods we were just talking about. I think there were like 2 fatal crashes in the last decade or something like that. So it wasn't like a completely arbitrary thing that they chose this particular area.
As you said, it was on Jatan Road, a stretch of Jatan Road, and they had this thing set up for 2 hours on Sunday afternoon. They wrote 21 speeding tickets in 2 hours with people going more than 10 miles over the speed limit, which I understand is 35 miles an hour. Have they done this? Has the sheriff's department done this with any frequency elsewhere around the county?
Well, there was a deputy quoted this week who said that they have done things like this, but they haven't done it with as much frequency as Sheriff McFadden is planning on doing it. No. So I think this is a little bit of a ramp up, but not unprecedented.
Well, he said past sheriffs may not have exercised, this is a quote, may not have exercised their full rights, but I, as the 45th sheriff, a lot of 45s to think about, the 45th sheriff of Mecklenburg County, of beginning to exercise those rights. Sorry, they would offend some people. So are people aware that the sheriff's department can even do this? Do you think that that's the job of the police?
Yeah, I think that that's probably confounding a few people, too, is that they didn't even know that the sheriff's department does this or can do it.
Because he said the sheriff's operation, they've been conducting speed operations or traffic enforcement, to use his words, for about 5 or 6 years. And then he says past sheriffs haven't been doing this. So which is it? Have they done it or have they not done it?
Well, like I said, the comments, I don't know, but the comments I read from someone who has been part of the department before Gary McFadden was that they have done this, but on a limited basis, and now they're going to do it more often.
Is that because he comes from a police department background?
It's a good question. I haven't heard his reasoning beyond the general notion of public safety, but I think that going back to what Gwendolyn was saying is this really is kind of a microcosm of the whole criminal justice debate that we have all the time, and the great disparity between who is often punished and who isn't. And this is part of that.
Well, County Commission Chair Dave Gilroy up in Cornelius tried to end on what he called a positive note, because he said, I don't want you to be disrespected. And McFadden said, and I quote, it's too late for that. Wow.
Yeah.
Is there room to go forward here in Cornelius? All right. Taking it into the city of Charlotte, they have proposed new rules in the city now that would allow developers to exceed newly established limits on the heights of buildings near transit stations. This is very complicated. If they provide affordable housing or meet some other public goals. When did these height restrictions come into being? What are they, and why pass new height restrictions only to say, well, you can skirt those if you want?
I think they came into being around 2003 or something
like
that.
Yeah, with the area plans,
yeah.
I believe, is when those came in. So there are four area plans. They're tied to transit corridors. And obviously with all the development going on, you have projects that, or developers rather, who are building projects that would exceed that. And one way to perhaps still have the development and the density that a lot of people want and think is beneficial to the environment and other things is to have a bonus fee, is what they're calling it.
We're talking specifically now about transit corridors, which means Blue Line, right?
Yes.
Maybe Silver Line,
yes.
10 years from
right.
now, but Blue Line right now. So how high can you go along the Blue Line?
Well, it depends. Isn't it like between 130 feet and...
What does that mean? How tall is 100? Is it 3 stories, 4 stories, 5 stories? Six, what is that?
130 feet. Is that 10 to 12 stories?
I think it would be about 10 to 12. And then that's in the tallest district.
Yeah. Okay.
So that'd be 130 feet maximum. And then through this proposal, they could go up to 300 feet.
So 20 stories?
If it's within walking distance of a rapid transit
We're talking about really changing the character of neighborhoods then.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at what's going on in South End. I mean, look, already you're seeing taller buildings, and that's only going to continue as land becomes scarcer. And the idea, of course, is that if you want to build higher, then you either dedicate a portion of your space to affordable housing, or you pay into the housing trust fund, which would build or preserve affordable housing.
How many affordable housing units would they have to provide in order to go up higher, which is something I'm sure almost any developer would want to do, go up higher?
So for each additional foot above the current height limit in their respective district, developers would have to devote at least 10% of the units in their building to affordable housing, which is for, you know, a family of four, I think it is 80% of the median household income for the area.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, this was proposed by city planners, correct? And it's obviously supported by developers. What's the council's take on this?
I think some developers had an issue with it. Wasn't that the...
I don't know. You tell me. I'm sure they have some issues with regard to what they're going to get in return for kicking in affordable housing units.
I believe one of the concerns was having limits because they wanted to... The feeling was that the whole point of the transit investment is so that you get dense development, i.e. much taller, so why impede that? Why limit that? Of course, that's also beneficial if you're a developer and you want to build a building.
A lot of council members feel pretty good about this because they feel like they lost an opportunity to build more affordable housing, especially on the southern portions of the Blue Line.
So when will they make a decision on this? Do we know?
We don't have a date. Okay. But
council also took up this week a proposal to build an 85-unit age-restricted facility along Mallard Creek Road, just past the intersection of Mallard Creek and Prosperity Church Road. It does not fit the development plan for that area adopted by council in 2015. It calls for lower density, that plan does at least. Are the neighbors in the area complaining about this new project, or are concerns coming strictly from council members about allowing this to happen along that corridor or at that intersection?
A lot of neighbors signed up to speak in opposition to this one. This was one of the two projects that had some significant backlash at the zoning meeting on Monday. The other one was Mayfield Memorial Church in Hidden Valley. That is a proposal for the church to be allowed to put about 50 affordable townhomes and apartments on its property, but a lot of the Hidden Valley neighborhood is concerned about it because they feel like the neighborhood already has enough affordable housing.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, and you have people, as you mentioned, Hidden Valley, people who say they want home ownership as opposed to bringing in more apartments. And when you talk about going against the master plans for these areas, I mean, the city seems to do that often. They have these plans for these communities, and then when the developers come in and you have a lot of development people on the zoning and planning committees, and those master plans kind of go out the door.
And who it tends to be very aggressive in terms of campaign donations. Yeah. Yes.
You mean developers get their way here? Who knew? Let's talk about scooters for a second. There are lots of scooters, and there are three companies that run these scooters, and I think they have the right to have 400 scooters each running on the streets of Charlotte. That's 1,200 scooters.
It's not enough, Mike.
Pretty much in uptown. So anyway, they've only been here for about 10 months, but they are ubiquitous, and city officials have been discussing safety and other issues surrounding these scooters for a while now. They want to test whether small fees can be used to incentivize good parking and scooter safety behavior. What are they considering?
So it's things like where you park your scooter, how you use your scooter. Are you wearing a helmet? I'm trying to think what else was in. Those were the two that I heard.
How would they know that information? Because as I understand the way the fees would work, the companies will pay the fees, and then you will pay by increased rates to ride the scooters. So how would the companies know whether you wore a helmet or whether you parked your scooter in a safe place?
Well, for parking, you have to take a picture of your scooter when you lock it up. You have to take a picture of where you're parking the scooter. So I imagine the companies have access to that and they can provide it to the city. So if you're parking it in the middle of the sidewalk, they'll find that out.
You'll pay a higher fee.
If you're zooming down the sidewalk because you're not supposed to be on the sidewalk, if you're not wearing a helmet, how would they know?
That's a good question. I don't.
There's a company, isn't it, that it is going to be tracking all of this?
Is it Passport?
Yes.
But
exactly.
How would they know?
Oh, they know, Mike.
Okay. More to come on that. You can be certain of that in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We mentioned last week that since it's Saturday morning, we can talk about alcohol. We mentioned last week that craft breweries were about to get a break because there was a new legislation that would allow them to brew more beer and still distribute it themselves and not go through the big distributors. Now, craft distilleries, this is different, may get a boost from a House and Senate bill that would level the regulatory field for them. If passed, what would it do?
I think it would allow them to sell more different, like other types of alcohol in their facilities. Right?
And it would allow them to distribute directly to bars and restaurants without necessarily having to go through the ABC. Normally, restaurants have to buy from the ABC board, and they usually have to buy a case. And if you're a craft distillery, maybe you only want one or two bottles on hand at any given time. Now, these are people that are brewing, what, bourbons and
right.
things like that.
Yes.
As opposed to beers and wine. And so it would allow them, as I understand it, to and I take a particular interest in this.
Keep sipping, Mike.
As I understand it, it would allow them to operate more like these craft breweries do today and more like the wineries in North Carolina.
Yeah. It seems like we have an endless list of debates and policy discussions on craft alcohol of all kinds. So this would only make sense to follow the craft beer discussion.
Because we're still fighting prohibition.
Yes, we are.
Because all the things that we're fighting came as a result of prohibition.
Look, Junior Johnson did his best. What more do you want?
And Katie, you report that increased property taxes may be about to be felt at craft beer taps. And you said before we started the show, as we were talking about some of the stories we talked about today, that you thought that would get a lot of your readers' attention. That has not been proven to be the case?
Yeah, I'm saying your craft beer is going to get more expensive, and it was sort of a blip on the radar, but that's okay.
How do you know that?
What do you mean?
How do you know it was a blip on the radar?
Oh, you know.
Clicks.
Clicks,
okay,
yeah.
Website clicks.
But Katie, it was March Madness. They may have been over-served, so they'll come back to it. They'll
exactly.
savor the story later.
Exactly, they'll come back to it.
So this is surrounding property taxes, right?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, for good reason, there's been a lot of attention paid to the residential property revaluation. You know, areas in kind of trendy neighborhoods close to transit area or close to transit is getting more expensive. Of course, that's same of commercial property, so they will have to pass those fees down.
Andy Peralta from the Charlotte Observer. We have to take a break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eric Spanberger is here, managing editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News. Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer. And Joe Bruno from Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Charlotte has a new city attorney. Many people don't know this. Patrick Baker has taken over for Bob Hageman, who retired. And he's been in the job for about 2 weeks now, mm-hmm. sworn in 2 weeks ago. He told city council that Charlotte was the only place he would have left Durham for. I don't know what to say about that.
What?
He also mentioned it in an interview that you, Eric, conducted with him, and he sees similarities between the two cities. What are they?
Well, let me go back to your first comment, because it does sound a little jarring. When he explained that to me, though, it made more sense, which is that when you're a municipal attorney, you tend to stay in the same state. You don't tend to go elsewhere.
Same city.
No, same state.
Same state, okay.
Same state because when you move around job-wise,
okay,
because you have an understanding of the state constitution, and so if he went to Wyoming or California, there would be a lot more to learn. So a lot of municipal attorneys would look at what cities are most appealing to me, and he said, obviously, Charlotte is the largest city, and so that made it appealing, and he has dealt a lot with economic mobility issues in Durham. Obviously, that's a lot of what's going on here. In fact, I think every week on this show we talk about affordable housing now, so he'll be immersed in some of that. And then he also gets a couple of fun bonuses, such as how do I negotiate with a guy who has $12 billion in an NFL team and wants some new toys over at the stadium?
Well, he talked about, I think, with you or with – because you talked to him too, didn't you? Or
Mark Rumsey did.
He talked with one of you about – the Durham Bulls mm-hmm. and the ballpark downtown, and now he gets to talk to the Panthers. There's a little difference between...
And he said that. He said, look, everything's bigger and it's a larger scope, but that when you consider it in its context, the Durham Bulls are to Durham as the Carolina Panthers are to Charlotte. So make of that what you will. The other aspect I would mention is, of course, the Republican National Convention, which takes up a lot of a city attorney's time, as Bob Hageman could tell you.
Yeah, and he did tell you that, as you mentioned, that in Durham they're talking about economic mobility issues, as we are, and affordable housing, as we are. Is there anything that he can bring to the table that perhaps we haven't thought of that he talked to you about?
He did not mention specifics to me. He just said that he is eager to dig into that. In terms of the differences of the job, he said that he was already getting notes from people he had worked with about the Silver Line and having multiple light rail systems when, of course, in Durham they're in a very painful and protracted battle to get just one light rail line, and that's not working out so well at the moment.
Go ahead.
He talked about also with Mark, WFAE's ATC host, about immigration issues. Mm-hmm. And he talked about whether or not his, in terms of releasing videos of crime scenes and especially when there have been shootings involving police officers. Mm-hmm. And he said that his position was to be transparent in terms of the releasing of videos by the police department. Now, when he talked about immigration, he was a little more vague. He talked about he would, look to his bosses. And one thing that he said that kind of got my attention, he said, I never knew the clear definition of a sanctuary city. And he talked about Durham, how he defended Durham, saying Durham was not a sanctuary city, even though it was on list, I think, as a sanctuary city, if I'm correct. And he said there was no clear definition, but he says, of course, in Durham, we were welcoming to everybody, but he would kind of take the lead when he got here from officials here in terms of how to handle immigration.
That echoes what the mayor has called the city, a welcoming, inclusive city, which is kind of nebulous, but nonetheless probably accurate.
One thing I wanted to mention real quickly, Mike, that's interesting about this city attorney, Patrick Baker, is so he was an assistant city attorney for many years in Durham, and then he became the city manager because they had a very painful parting with the city manager, and the council couldn't reach consensus on the deputy city managers, and they came to him and said, hey, why don't you do it? And he ended up doing it for 4 years and then became city attorney. And I mention all that because that is a very unique perspective for a city attorney to actually understand what the city manager's job entails.
And, you know, HB2, which was directed at Charlotte and its passage of its non-discrimination ordinance that allowed LGBTQ and transgender people to use the bathroom of their choice, which was shot down by HB2, when Mark Rumsey, WFA's Mark Rumsey, talked to Mr. Baker about this, he asked whether Charlotte should be able to legally pass a similar non-discrimination policy. Do you remember what he said?
I think on that he said he wasn't going to take a position on that on policy. You know, he would, again, wait till he got here, talk, see what his bosses said, and I think he described himself kind of as a peace broker. So I think he's kind of taking a, kind of not coming out.
But he came to the right place if he's a peace broker.
He said, my job is to make recommendations based on what the law is. And that's where it gets a little tricky to answer the question because the law keeps changing. With each session, the General Assembly could put out a new rule that I would need to interpret and then advise. Okay. West Charlotte's men's basketball team has found themselves a couple weeks ago in the center of a controversy surrounding a racial slur, but they played through that to win a ticket to the 4A state championship. That game will be played in Raleigh on Saturday.
It was played. Yes.
They did not win.
They lost by about 26 points. They played against Wintersville's South Central, and South Central had only lost one game. They had lost six over the season, but they. I talked to them, and I went to an event prior to that game last weekend, and they thought that they were prepared. They said they were not letting that racial slur, which was issued by a Audrey Kell High School white student against them, they were not going to let that get in the way of their focus, and they felt like they were ready to take it all. Their coach said if they played great defense and they would win it, but even during the game, they said the fans turned out in large numbers. And that's one thing that came out of all of this. The alumni came and out to their practices, to their games, in hordes to support them, to let them know that we are behind you, we are proud of you, and don't let this slur get in the way of you thinking any differently about yourself, you know, whether on the court, in the classroom, wherever. Okay. You can do it, and we're behind you.
Joe?
I think it's cool that David Tepper took care of them, too. He paid for their coach buses all the way up to Chapel Hill. He paid for their hotel rooms the night before as well, so they could get a good night's rest and they wouldn't have to drive up the day of.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
he did.
They had had they had to move that earlier playoff game, too. There was a lot of obviously dissatisfaction about that they had to move that game off
the
campus.
They did. They played. Their gym can only hold about 450 students, and they were expecting about 2,000 people.
Yikes.
For this game. And even when they played the game before the final at Lenore Ryan, a lot of people from Charlotte went to that game and were not even able to get in there. So some people thought it was, again, another hit against them that, you know, a lot of the Audrey Kell parents who are higher income don't want to come to West Charlotte. But according to school officials and according to athletic officials, they have moved games before. So that game was played at Vance, which had a much larger gym. Now, they are going to get a new school, and they talked about that, say, well, this won't be a problem once we get our new school. And I think that's supposed to happen in 2020.
Speaking of new schools, former UNC Chancellor Carol Folt, unceremoniously ousted 2 months ago from UNC Chapel Hill, has found a new job at the other USC. Where did she land? It's the University of Southern California.
Yeah, I believe she landed in Los Angeles. And, of course, she was in Chapel Hill during a very long athletics scandal.
Right.
involving the...
She's going to another school that's at the center of this controversy.
And this one is probably more complicated and will take longer to unwind if that's possible.
Did that play a role in her getting this job because she has experience with athletic scandals?
I wondered that, too. I don't know. I have not heard that, but I know that the coverage instantly, the LA Times and others were saying that she at least is familiar with some of the pressures and the scrutiny that comes with this type of investigation and this type of problem. But
so she arrived.
And they said she was the top candidate, and two, because she has dealt with not just the athletic issues, which involved, you know, students being allowed to get credit for courses they never showed up for.
Right.
But, you know, she right now they're looking at USC as one of the ones named in the admissions
scandal. Right, right, varsity blues.
So she arrived at UNC Chapel Hill at the beginning of that scandal. She had nothing to do with that athletic scandal, and she left.
No.
She was ousted because of her decision to remove Silent Sam and later on the pedestal that Sam sat on. Now she's going to a university that is involved in an athletic scandal. Will she have to take down the Kardashian statue?
I knew this was building to something, and we'd already had the Young and the Restless in this show, so we have to get the Kardashians
in. LA-centric.
I think at minimum we can say that beyond the Kardashians and the Young and the Restless, Carol Folt likes a good challenge, so she has one.
And they also asked, she was on NPR this morning and talked about, you know, with this admission scandal, okay, they have a thing where if you graduated from USC, your children get priority, and asked her, would you get rid of that? Is that part of this problem now with, you know, wealthy students being allowed to be admitted? So she said she doesn't know at this point that, but she wants to, you know, hear from everybody, be transparent in what she does, and she's looking forward to taking on the challenge. Plus, it'll be a much larger campus.
Meanwhile, only 5 of 17 UNC system schools have their student IDs approved as voter IDs. Who made that decision? Is that the Board of Elections that made that decision?
Correct.
Okay. Was this a surprise that these IDs could not be used as voter IDs?
Yes, I believe it was. The State Board of Elections justified it by saying, hey, we have these really strict rules that we have to follow from the state legislature, so that's why a lot of these schools didn't make the cut. As far as local schools that did make the cut, App State did, Davidson did, Johnson C. Smith, Elon University, they all made the cut, but UNC Charlotte was one of those UNC schools that did not.
So evidently, the law that the legislature passed with regard to voter ID says that the photograph on the voter ID is a photograph that has to be taken by what, the university? You can't supply it to the university. They have to take it, and a lot of these voter IDs, they allow you to supply your own picture. Is that part of it?
That is, and that was one of the things that they said that why they would challenge some of these colleges' IDs.
So State Elections Director Kim Stack has told state legislators that her staff is willing to work with them on a legislative remedy, but I'm told key legislators disagree on any need to change parts of the voter ID law to fix things. Well, if you can't use your student ID, doesn't that mean something needs to be fixed? Is it that these legislators don't want young people to vote?
I think they're going to fix it. I think that they will take this up. At least what the legislatures are saying is they don't want to prevent anyone from voting. They don't want this to be a hiccup. They just want this to be able to verify that they are the person they claim to be when right. they go to the polls. I would be shocked if they didn't try to fix this.
And in the meantime, schools are trying to fix it themselves. As you said, there's a long list of those who did get the okay. UNC Charlotte officials say they are meeting next week to try and determine how they can fix theirs. So their students, Johnson C. Smith, said they have done all the paperwork for the upcoming election. So yes, the schools in the meantime are not just sitting back and waiting for something to happen.
Okay. The continuing saga continues on voter ID. It's the local news roundup this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. The presidential campaign is focusing on South Carolina again this week. Beto O'Rourke, I think, is here right now.
As we speak.
As we speak would be Friday.
Oh, whoops.
And Peter.
As we spoke.
Sorry. And Pete, the mayor Pete. Pete Buttigieg. Is that how you say it?
Katie, Katie knows. She's a Notre Dame alum.
Go ahead.
Buttigieg.
Say it again.
Buttigieg.
Buttigieg.
In his Twitter bio, it says Boot Edge Edge.
Boot Edge Edge. We have to practice that for when he becomes president.
Yes, there you go.
He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's planning a stop in Greenville, Columbia, and Rock Hill Saturday. How big a role is the Palmetto State going to play in the Democratic nomination?
Well, it always is very prominent because it's one of the first four. So we always have this flood of early appearances.
But there are more candidates, Democratic candidates, than there are Democrats. In South Carolina.
I think you still want to win that primary. I think that is the message. Also, Cory Booker will be here in South, not in Charlotte, but in South Carolina. And next week, CNN is going to be in Orangeburg with Don Lemon hosting Cory Booker. So there are all kinds of candidates coming to the Palmetto State.
And what's interesting is they're choosing Rock Hill to come to. And one reason I think that they're focusing a little bit on upstate South Carolina is that the North Carolina primary this year is March 3rd. Mm-hmm. So as South Carolina voters head to the polls early, voting will be underway, so they're kind of getting the best of both worlds by focusing on
Charlotte media.
Yeah, I was going to say they love the double dip in the Charlotte media market.
And speaking of Rock Hill, that's where the Panthers are rumored to be wanting to place their headquarters and practice facility when word got out about the meeting between David Tepper and South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster about locating the game. Some people fretted about a loss of tax revenue to Charlotte if the team headquarters was there. You reported, Katie, this week that those worries are probably going to be overblown. How so?
Well, I think that both Charlotte and Rock Hill or York County, wherever we're talking about in South Carolina, would both benefit from new development by way of, you know, new entertainment, new restaurants, bars, hotels, and the additional jobs and construction that comes with that. But the other thing is, I think it was McMaster that touted this $190 million payroll figure as beneficial for South Carolina, and that's not exactly the case because the team's highest paid employees, the players and the coaches, are taxed where they play games. And as you know,
who made that decision? Is that a federal decision or is that a state decision?
No, it's something called a jock tax.
Yeah, but who made that decision?
It's years old. I think it started in the 90s or something.
Yeah, I thought is it state by state that figures that out?
It only really, impacts the Panthers and the Redskins because the Redskins practice in Virginia and play in Maryland.
Yes,
but it applies to other sports as well.
Well, I want to say before we go, congratulations to Joe Bruno, who was honored for breaking news investigation reporting uncovering election fraud in the 9th Congressional District. You and the station were both winners of the 10th Biennial Walter Cronkite Awards for Excellence in Television Political Journalism. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Joe Bruner from Channel 9, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Katie Peralta from The Observer, and Gwendolyn Glenn. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.